Hey there, Sports History fans. Arnie Chapman here from the Sports History Network to share with you an awesome announcement. Now dig on this. Four of our amazing podcasts have clinched spots in the final round of the Sports Podcast Awards, and we need your support to take home the trophy. First up, we've got Basketball History 101, Driving the Lane in the Best Basketball category. Then on deck, we've got Orville Mulligan, Sports Writer. He's cracking up the competition in the Best Sports Comedy category. Marty's Illegal Stick is dominating the ice next in the Best Hockey category. And last but not least, we have Wrestling with Heels on powerbombing its way to victory in the Best Wrestling category. Now, again, we're counting on you to cast your vote and help out these incredible podcasters secure their well-deserved recognition. It's super easy. All you gotta do is head over to the dedicated landing page. That's at sportshistorynetwork.com/vote. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/vote. Now, let's take another look at sports yesteryear with this episode brought to you by, of course, the Sports History Network.
So you think the football season's over because the Super Bowl is just completed? Well, it's not, my friends, because we are going to go through some football history throughout the year, as promised, on a daily basis. And today we start off our project of going through the uniforms, talking with Bill Schaefer of the Gridiron Uniforms. He's coming up along with your football history headlines for February 8th in just a moment. This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. This is your host, Aaron Hayes, and we're broadcasting from the Pig Pen in Western Pennsylvania to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So with Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff supplying us with the tunes, let's go no huddle through today's football history headlines.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com, and welcome once again to the Pig Pen as we will go through the football history headlines of February 8th. And today, we are going to kick off an endeavor since the football season's over, and this is the first day of the off season with the Super Bowl now being completed. We are going to start a project where we are going to go through all of the football uniform jersey numbers and the great players that represented them of substance in the NFL. We will talk about each one of them that we can, and we will have guests along the way. And today, to kick it off, we have Bill Schaefer of the Gridiron Uniform Database, who's going to give us some history on uniforms and some detail of uniforms that maybe I know I didn't notice before, but now when I watch games, I certainly do. So we'll come up with Bill in just a minute, but let's get you your football history headlines for this February 8th. Let's start off in the year 1936. The first ever NFL draft took place as Jay Berwanger from the University of Chicago was the first pick by the Philadelphia Eagles that year. According to the Pro Football Hall of Fame's website, before this inaugural draft, players could sign with any team they so desired. But this practice caused a great disparity in the NFL. In fact, many of the sports franchises such as the Bears, Giants, held somewhat of a monopoly on the good players, and thus they were perennial contenders. That is when the owner of the Eagles and future NFL commissioner, Burt Bell, introduced a proposal of the NFL draft to help bring parity into the league. Of course, the bigger market teams were against this, but Bell and company convinced them that it was essential for the league's survival. On May 19, 1935, the plan was called for the teams to select players in reverse order of their finish of the previous season, and that was passed, and it was first used in this 1936 draft. We'll talk more about Burt Bell and his introduction of the NFL draft on our February 25th podcast when we talk to Burt Bell's son, Upton Bell, in a real exclusive interview on the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch. February 8th, 1960, the Oakland Raiders co-owner Y.C. Chet Soda was named as the franchise's first general manager. February 8th, 1963, the AFL's Dallas Texans moved out of the state of Texas and relocated in Missouri to become the Kansas City Chiefs that we know today. Lamar Hunt was the owner of both places. February 8th, 1996, the NFL and the city of Cleveland allowed Art Modell to relocate his NFL franchise to Baltimore, Maryland. But the Browns' nickname and moniker was separated from that Modell-owned franchise and had to stay with the city of Cleveland. As we later learned, the Cleveland Browns were resurrected in the late 90s. February 8th, 2004, Aloha Stadium in Honolulu. Mark Bulger of the St. Louis Rams, quarterback, was the most valuable player award in the NFL Pro Bowl as his NFC teammates outscored the AFC by the amazing final score of 55-52. February 8, 2009, at the 2008 season's NFL Pro Bowl, that was also played at Aloha Stadium in Honolulu, Hawaii, the National Conference again defeated the American Conference, this time by the score of 30-21. The MVP of the game was the season's top players, was Arizona Cardinals' terrific wide receiver, Larry Fitzgerald. As we mentioned, we have Bill Schaefer coming up in just a few minutes to talk about the history of the gridiron uniform in the NFL. And before we get to him, let's talk about some birthdays for this February 8th of Hall of Famers. And we'll start off February 8th, 1920, Faribault, Minnesota. The Minnesota Golden Gophers halfback Bruce "Boo" Smith was born. Boo was famous for helping grasp victory from the depths of apparent defeat, doing it with long runs and dramatic moments, and leading Minnesota to the national title in 1940 and 1941. In pacing the Gophers to their first back-to-back 8-0 campaigns, Smith was the man the team leaned on in 1940. Smith had a knack for producing scoring come-from-behind touchdowns that brought the crowds out of their seats and escaped the threats by the likes of Nebraska, Ohio State, and Michigan. The more Boo played, the better he got. In 1941, he ran through the competition and won the Heisman Trophy. After graduation, Boo was the most valuable player in the 1942 Chicago College All-Star Game against the NFL's Chicago Bears. Boo Smith was honored with induction into the College Football Hall of Fame in 1972 after the National Football Foundation tallied their votes. February 28, 1925, the University of California's great guard Rod France garnered his born-on date. The NFF reminds us that Rod helped turn around a subpar Cal program into contenders. France was an honorable mention in All-America listing as a freshman, but then France became the second Pacific Coast player to become a three-time All-America player. The National Football Foundation selected Rod France for entrance into the College Football Hall of Fame in 1977. February 8, 1942, Mount Prospect, Illinois. George Bork, the fantastic quarterback from Northern Illinois, arrived into this life. George was a four-year football letterman at NI, but only played quarterback in his final three seasons, according to the footballfoundation.org website. Bork led the nation in total offense and passing in 1962, and after his coaching staff installed the shotgun spread formation. George thrived in this system as he completed 232 passes for 2,506 yards. He repeated in 1963 with 244 completions for over 3,000 yards. The school retired his jersey number 11 at the end of his Husky playing days. George Bork received the great honor of being selected for inclusion into the Football Hall of Fame in 1999. February 8, 1948, Northampton, Pennsylvania. The stud Penn State University linebacker Dennis Onconce was born. Dennis had a nose for finding the man with the ball and dropping him to the dirt as he earned All-America honors as a linebacker in 1968 and 1969. According to the National Football Foundation, Onconce intercepted 11 passes and scored on pick sixes on three of them. He was also outstanding and electric as a punt returner. In his three seasons, he held an average of 13.2 yards per punt return. His talent extended beyond that, too, as he also led the Nittany Lions in tackles and was named as an All-American academic in that year. The National Football Foundation selected Dennis Onconce for the entrance into the College Football Hall of Fame in 1995. Okay, and now, as promised, I want to bring in this Bill Schaefer interview that we did just a few weeks ago. And Bill, I'll tell you a little bit about him. He is with the GridironUniforms.com website. It's the Gridiron Uniform Database, or the GUD as we're going to refer to it. And what is the Gridiron Uniform Database? Well, it's a website that presents graphical representations of every uniform that's ever been worn in the NFL since 1920. The Pigskin Dispatch has been permitted to use by Bill post some of those great graphics that the Gridiron Uniform Database has shown on multiple occasions, especially in September and October when we were talking about some of the older teams. Bill, you're on the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch podcast. Bill Schaefer, welcome to the Pigpen.
Welcome to you. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, Bill, we want to get a little bit into what your site does first so our listeners understand, for those that may not be familiar with what's going on. Can you tell us a little bit more about the Gridiron Uniform Database and what it's all about?
Well, to understand what it is, you kind of have to understand the beginnings of where it came from. I grew up in Pennsylvania, and my dad is still, to this day, a season ticket holder for the Pittsburgh Steelers. And so, you know, around age five or so, he started taking me to Steeler home games, and I started collecting the old-fashioned, IHOP mini magnets, the helmets, and everything.
Oh, I remember
so
those.
Every game we went to, I got a new helmet and everything. So I kind of inadvertently got into this through that. I went to college at the University of Miami, and I moved back down here from Pennsylvania down to Florida around 2002, and I took a job. I'm a teacher. I took a job at a school, and the school that I started working at was basically my first encounter with the Internet. And so I set up my computer in my classroom, and I stumbled across a website in my off time called Football Uniforms Past and Present. And it's basically the forerunner of our website, the Gridiron Uniform Database, in that it displayed the team's uniforms, but it only went back to 1959, I think it was. They did 1 year of NFL only, and then they started including both the AFL and NFL. But while it was a great site, and it was really the only one that fit into the niche of football uniforms, it did have some problems with it. They didn't include any of the memorial patches or anniversary patches. Some of the colors weren't right. Some of the fonts of the jersey numbers weren't right. And so I said to myself, you know, these are really cool images. So I started saving them and using them as screensavers for myself on my computer.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, the guy that ran the site stopped updating it after the 2003 season. And so I decided, well, you know what? Let me try my hand. And so I started tweaking his existing images to update the changes teams were making. And that worked okay. I wasn't really good at it. It worked okay for a couple of years. And then I think it was when either San Diego or Minnesota around 2006, 2007, somewhere around there, did a complete overhaul of their uniforms. It was really the first overhaul since I had been doing this. And I was like, there's no way I can do it with his images because the template he used was like a 3D image. And so I was trying to come up with something I could use, and I just happened to stumble across an image that someone had posted, and it was on Google Images of someone's attempt to draw what they thought the 2009, the original AFL teams when they wore the 2009 throwbacks, like the Broncos wearing the brown and yellow and, Chargers wearing the powder blues and everything. And it was a really good template to use. So I thought, man, maybe I can adapt this not just for the 2009 AFLs, but maybe the rest of the uniforms. So I tried my hand, and I wasn't even thinking about, you know, putting it out on the internet. I was just doing something for my own stuff. And around that time, it also happened to coincide with me discovering Paul Lucas's UniWatch website. And
great website, by the way, there also.
Yes. Paul's been a big help, and likewise, I've helped him and been credited on a couple of his articles that he's written for SportsIllustrated.com for like his yearly previews and stuff like that. So, you know, Paul and I have a real good relationship with that. But when I found his website, there was a topic. Let me just see if I can click to it here. There's a button up at the top of his website that says research projects, and I clicked on that, and there were two tabs under research projects that caught my eye. One said white at home at the NFL, and another one was NFL history. And so I thought, wow, that NFL history, let me see what that is. And what it was basically just a list of topics written by a gentleman named Tim Bruglia, who also lives in Pennsylvania, and he went through using old video and newspaper photos and basically wrote a verbal description of what each team's uniforms looked like all the way back to the 1930s.
Now, just to pause you just for a second, Tim, those of our listeners that are football historians, see a lot of Tim's work on the PFRA website. He has quite a bit of contribution to them. Please continue. I'm sorry.
Oh, not a problem. Not a problem. And so I thought, you know what? Nobody's going to see these. Let me see what I can do. And so I started messing with his descriptions. I manufactured some leather helmet templates for back in the 30s and 40s.
That had to be tricky.
It wasn't the easiest thing, but, you know, and because I was new to this, I was far from a graphic designer by any stretch of the imagination. But I gave it my shot. And there was a note at the end of Tim's little essay there that said anybody that would like to take on the project of putting these into visual images, please contact me. And so I did, and from that point on began a flurry of back and forth, me sending him pictures and him saying, okay, could you make that blue just a little bit darker? You know, could you lighten the green a little bit here? And so I just basically sent everything that I was making. You know, I'd send him like 10 years worth of Chicago Bears images, and we'd go through and we'd, you know, tinker and fine tune those. And then we'd do another decade, and until we got through absolutely everything. And it originally intended to be just to cover 1932, which was the first year of an actual quote-unquote NFL championship game where the Bears and Portsmouth Spartans actually had to play indoors at Chicago Stadium due to a blizzard. That was really the first NFL championship game. So we kind of used that as a starting point, and we were just going to work all the way forward to 1960, figuring, well, Craig Wheeler's football uniforms past and present takes care of everything forward. And so when we got to everything up through 1960, we said, you know, let's try to fix what Craig Wheeler has by, you know, tweaking it with our own template and stuff. And then maybe if we get okay with that, maybe we can work forward from where his site left off after 2003 and catch up to, I think it would have been like about 2010 or 2011 by this point. And so we did, and we got everything kind of where we wanted it to be, but neither Tim nor I had the wherewithal to be able to create an actual website, you know, 10 years ago.
Right.
And so that's when Tim contacted Paul Lucas, and he said, you know, I got this guy that's done all this artwork for us, and we're trying to find a website. So Paul Lucas ran a couple weekend entries on his site, one from Tim's point of view and one from my point of view, you know, talking about basically everything that I've just discussed with you here, saying, if there's anybody out there in the UniWatch universe that would like to help Tim and Bill create a website, please contact us. And that's how we got in contact with our original web designer, Rob Haleko. And he went ahead and created the original version of our website where we just posted, okay, here's, you know, all the collection of uniforms worn by each team each year. And it was just basically a collection of, now here's 1970, here's 1971, here's 1972. And once we got all that in, we started saying, you know, hey, Rob, how difficult would it be to actually create a separate page for each week of the season And so that, you know, somebody said, hey, you know, 1977, what did week one look like in 1977? Bang, and now we can click on 1977, week one, and we see all the matchups from week
and
one
that,
of 1977.
That is so cool to have that, be able to do that, too. I've used that many times myself.
It's in fact, a funny story, a couple of years after we started the website, I got a thank you letter from a lawyer in New York. And he was prosecuting a guy who claimed that he was out of town at a Jets game in Atlanta for a preseason game, and he posted pictures on his Facebook page of him at a game in the Georgia Dome, and you could see the teams in the background. Well, what the lawyer did was he went on our site, clicked on the game for that week, and as it turns out, the teams were in different uniforms than what they were wearing in the background of the guy using his picture. And so he used that to say, so these pictures are from that game, right? Yes, yes, they were. Well, funny you should mention that, because, and then he went on to use our website, and he went on and he accessed, I guess, like New York Times photos to prove that the pictures that he used were from a game a couple years prior rather than that week.
You're almost like an expert witness in the trials that go on of football fans.
Yeah, and so, you know, actually, you know, our website helped, you know, I guess, get a conviction on this guy. So, you know, just there's been a lot of stories. I've had a mom call and say, thank you for creating this website. Her five-year-old, she feels safe that she can put him on GUD and he can spend hours and hours just clicking through all the pictures and everything. And so, you know, it's just little things like that. And, you know, it's, from our point of view, the whole site's really a labor of love. I mean, we're not getting anything out of it. You know, I'd had thoughts once upon a time of, you know, somehow creating like a coffee table book out of everything that we've done. But, mm-hmm. you know, just being able to get in touch with someone, you know, in the book business that, you know, would be interested in taking on such a thing, you know, we've tried, but, you know, we've come up short in that regard. So,
well, with your volume of work, it would probably be about, you'd need volumes of it, be like encyclopedias,
thinking, yeah, you'd probably have to separate it by decades and stuff.
Well, one thing that I've really noticed about it that was, I found kind of astonishing being a viewer of your website, and you see so many old photographs of old NFL games, you know, from the 1920s, 1930s. And I don't know, in the 21st century, we've sort of, at least I relate, I'm saying, okay, this is black and white. These uniforms are all kind of gray and drab and dark. But you get onto your site and you bring a whole new light into what these uniforms look. I mean, there's some very vibrant colors back in early NFL.
Yeah, and what's really helped us, and here I go plugging another one of our, you know, communication aid.
Please do.
Mr. Donovan Moore had a site, I can't remember what it used to be called Colorworks, Colorwerx, but he has since renamed it True Color, TrueColor, and on it, he got through with some of the Hall of Fames and everything, and he's basically got the Pantone squares of the colors used for like almost every single team all the way back into the 20s, I guess through contacts at the Hall of Fame or whatnot. So using Donovan's site for the color aspect, once we get a black and white picture of a team's uniform, you know, like one of the really popular combinations back in the 20s was like a maroon burgundy color and maybe like an off-white cream color. Well, when you look at a black and white picture, you can tell which one's the burgundy and which one's the cream. So it's just a matter of assigning those colors once you make the actual drawing.
Well, you do an excellent job at it.
Well, yeah, it's difficult. The hardest part, and Tim Bruglia, you know, spearheads this whenever we have issues with it. On black and white, it's almost impossible to tell the difference between blue and red.
And
the only thing you can use kind of as a guide, apparently, and this is one of the things that I've picked up doing this site, is I learned a lot about black and white film for photographs. And namely, back in the 40s and 50s, when you took black and white photography, your camera, you could either put in what was either a red filter or a blue filter. And depending on which filter you used, it would highlight the difference between the red or the blue. So, like, I always refer to, like, the New York Giants, you know, because a lot of people without our website wouldn't know that, you know, way back when, the Giants' primary color was red, not blue. And so, knowing that they normally wore red, the cameramen would have used a red filter, and so you can see their jerseys actually appearing a little bit lighter than their navy blue helmets, and especially close-ups, like for night games with flash photography, you can see where their red jersey matches the red stripe going down the center of their navy helmet. Versus where they were playing like another team that wore red, like the Brooklyn Dodgers, where the Giants would have worn their blue jerseys, and the blue filter makes the blue jerseys match the blue helmet and contrast the red stripe going down the middle of the helmet. So there's a lot of like little idiosyncrasies that, you know, you have to use. And, you know, whenever I get stuck, you know, I default and go running home to mom and call Tim and say, Tim, what's your opinion here? And, you know, let the, you know, as close as we have to an expert with that, do the trick. But, you know, between getting a pretty clear black and white photo and having Donovan's color reference to refer to, it's pretty much then just color by numbers.
I just want to make sure that our listeners understand. I mean, full disclosure, first of all, Bill and I started. I contacted Bill back probably in the late spring of 2020 to see if we could use some of his graphics on pigskindispatch.com, and we got into a conversation. And Bill is actually, he lives in Florida now, but when he said he was from Pennsylvania, full disclosure, he is from Erie, Pennsylvania, my hometown where I'm located currently, and Bill asked me to do an assignment at our local library on a game that was played between a Bethlehem semi-pro team and the Pittsburgh Steelers. I believe it was in the early 1940s, and he wanted to see if we had a newspaper photograph up here that I could get to him. I mean, the detail that you folks do, your whole team, of going to these old newspapers and, you know, telling the difference between the colors like you just described, and especially, it wasn't like they were the greatest photographs in the world back in the 30s and 40s in a newspaper.
Well, right, and not to mention the fact that, you know, you're looking off black and white photos that then have been placed in newspapers that are, you know, in some cases 70, 80, 90 years old, where the newspapers have since, you know, have the quality degrade a bit. And then you're talking about, you know, a lot of libraries putting those images on microfilm. So you're talking about, you know, basically it's like the olden days of making a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy on a Xerox machine. So any chance that we can get like a digital scan of an original black and white picture is like gold to us.
Oh, I bet.
Because it's so much crisper and clearer than, you know, doing the guesstimating sometimes that we have to do.
Hey, Bill, I just want to take you in a little bit different direction on your site.
Sure.
We talked a lot about the old stuff. Is there any, like, recent projects that you have on the site that folks could take a look at when they visit the GUD?
Well, usually when there's small fixes and then there's big fixes. Like, you know, if if I notice, you know, something, or somebody emails us a comment and says, hey, you know, you guys forgot the memorial patch in 2000, whatever, I can go back, I can do that real quick, real easy. It's a quick fix. But there's also things that are big fixes. And when we do the big fixes, generally after putting that much time into it, what I usually do is I create a blog entry, and our website has a blog button that you can look through, and basically it's a storytelling of some of the more recent big fixes that we've had to do. A couple of them that we've redone is, you know, we went through with a fine tooth comb the Minnesota Vikings, their helmet horn, noting all the little changes from year to year of the shape, the length, the color, the placement.
Wow.
And then same thing with the Steelers emblem. Ever since they put the logo on the side of their helmet around it would have been probably like the early 60s when they were in the playoff bowl was the first time that they wore a logo on their helmet, but the little hypocycloids, the three little shapes that are inside that logo.
Is that the official name for those,
yes,
those shapes?
Yes, they're hypocycloids.
Wow, we got a scientific aspect
term
of football here.
That's it. Geometry lesson while we're at it.
Yeah.
Originally, in the original logo, they weren't yellow, red, and blue as they are now. They were actually yellow, orange, and blue. And
wow.
So we've kind of charted the progression of the size of the emblem, the changing of the colors from an orange to a more reddish orange to a red and to what it is now with like a really deep red in the emblem. You know, just doing little stuff like that and not just saying, okay, well, in 1970 it changed to this, but also including photos that show the change from one year to the next so that, you know, the our viewers that come on can see, oh, yeah, okay, I can see what he's talking about there.
Oh, that's
so
awesome.
You know, we've done that. And then one of my favorite ones that I've done I did over the summer, it's kind of a thing where you stumble on something by accident. I was driving home from the grocery store, and I was in the middle lane, and in the lane next to me was a new car that it wasn't white. It was kind of like a pearly white that had like the little sparkle flecks in it.
Oh, yeah, I'm familiar.
And I was like, you know, what does that remind me of? And so I spent the rest of the ride home trying to think, what am I thinking of? And then all of a sudden when I walked in the front door, it hit me. Every once in a while, I'd be watching like a 4 o'clock in the afternoon game or a Monday night football game, and it would be a team that wore white helmets, and the white of the helmet was more of like the eggshell color compared to like the car that I had seen, and you could really notice the difference in the night game under the lights because the helmet would take on that eggshell color versus the white of the team's away jersey. And what I found was in 2005, all the teams that wore white helmets went from a white helmet that matched their white jerseys to this eggshell color helmet. And every team's white helmet was this eggshell all the way through to 2017. And then for whatever reason, in 2018, all the white helmets reverted back to a crystal clear white that matched the white jerseys. And it was a really amazing thing to go through. And, you know, when you're not looking for it, you don't notice it. But
yeah,
when you're looking for it, you're like, oh, my gosh, look at that. The Titans' white helmet doesn't match their white jersey. The Jets' white helmet doesn't match the white jersey.
And interesting.
So just going through and finding all things like that. So whenever I get done with a project like that, I usually create a blog that goes through so you can see the pictures of what happened and everything. Right now, I'm actually kind of cloudy. I'm right in the middle of a project. we try to keep everything as historically accurate as possible. And one of the things that's always bothered me is in 1974, the Chiefs began wearing a white face mask, and the Chargers, I think, started wearing a yellow face mask. And it was the first time using a colored face mask other than, you know, just gray or black, something like that. And so we adopted a modern helmet template that we had used from 1974 all the way through to 2011. And it always bugged me that it just didn't fit for, you know, almost a 40-year time period to just use one kind of helmet and face mask model. And so what I did was I created a new face mask model for 1974 up to 82, and then kind of tweaked the existing model from 83 up to 11. And believe it or not, the thing that's gotten us the most is when we look back at the pictures from the 70s with face masks like the one that we're using, the clips that they used to hold the face mask in place up on the forehead and like on the side by the jaw were not always the same color as the actual bars of the face mask. And so we're like, you know, I can't show a gray face mask for the 49ers but be showing gray clips when the 49ers were one of the only teams at the time that actually colored their clips to match the helmet and not the gray of the face mask.
Well, you have a keen eye to see that. That's, that's remarkable.
And I'm lucky because, you know, for a long time, Tim and I were the only ones that did the research. And about 6 or 7 years ago, we had a gentleman from New York that was contributing a lot of questions and, hey, you need to fix this because I'm a big Giants fan and I know this was like this. Let me get you a photo for it. His name is Larry Schmidt, and he's actually a contributor on a website called Big Blue Interactive. And the website does podcasts where they contact Larry much in the same way, you know, you guys are talking to me to talk about, you know, stuff about Giants history and, you know, what can you tell us about this player and, you know.
We've actually used Larry both on the pigskindispatch.com. He's wrote a couple things on Giants because I go to him any New York football, professional football question. Larry is
the
expert.
The guy. He
actually came on the podcast and did a stint probably back in September, early October, on some things on the Giants history that came up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, fortunately for me, Larry is I don't like to toot my own horn, so I'm not going to, but Larry is absolutely my equal in terms of being able to dig through photos and have an eye for certain details and stuff. And so while I'm fixing these face masks and updating all the images on the site for a specific one team at a time, Larry has taken it upon himself to go through all these photos and do the digging. And so he created a spreadsheet for me, you know, for all the teams, for all the years, and he's going through, you know, and saying, okay, for the New York Giants, the clips were white, the clips were white, the clips were white, but in 1988 they changed to navy blue. And so it makes my job easier so I don't have to go back and forth digging up photos. I can just have a small window open with his spreadsheet, and so I can go through and fix these one at a time using, you know, what digging Larry has done for me. And I tell you, he's actually like the fifth Beatle, you know, on our website. He didn't start with us, but man, he's worth his weight.
So he's like Ringo Starr, the Ringo Starr of the GUD.
Yeah, we wouldn't be anywhere without him. I mean, we wouldn't be halfway as decent. Tim and I always joke that, you know, Al Davis always used to say, just win, baby. Well, the GUD's expression was, just get it right. So no matter what it took to, you know, to get our images to be as historically accurate as possible, to the point where, you know, around the 1990s, we started including the brand maker's marks, you know, putting the Reebok logos or the Adidas logos right where they need to be, and coloring them correctly and all that. Just anything that we can do to make the site accurate, that's what we've done. And Larry's been a big part of that from the research perspective.
But that's great. I'd like to transition. We're about to embark on 100 days on the Pigskin Dispatch podcast of going through, and we're recording this in mid-January, full disclosure to the listeners. This will be airing after the Super Bowl, so if we say anything that we don't know who wins the Super Bowl in 2021. But with these 100 days, we're going to go through the football jersey numbers of the professional level especially. We'll get a little bit into the college. We're going to start at zeros, work all the way up to 99, but I think it's a good jumping off point on that project. If we could get a little bit of the history of the, especially the football numbers on the football jersey, if you could help us out with that.
Well, I tell you, one of the things, there's two things about the jerseys that have really changed over the years. The most obvious, of course, is the sleeve length. You know, back in the 20s, 30s, 40s, and even into the 50s, football jerseys went all the way down to the wrist,
mm-hmm,
and with the sleeves. And around the 60s and 70s, they started getting shorter up to the elbow. And now, you know, you've got players like, what's his name, Michael Bennett, that basically looks like they're wearing a tank top over their shoulder pads. You know,
right,
the sleeves have gone away almost completely. And for me, that's a shame because, you know, personally, even though I'm a Bears fan, my all-time favorite jersey has always been the 70s Eagles with the sleeve stripes.
Ah, yeah, I remember those.
You know, the Ron Jaworski Eagles jerseys from the late 70s and early 80s. Those were always my favorite jerseys because of, you know, the sleeve stripes. And but now, with, you know, the jersey templates being what they are, you look at a team like the Steelers.
Mm-hmm.
The Steelers have that wonderful Northwest stripe pattern on their sleeves, but now because the sleeves have gotten so abbreviated, they can only fit the top half of the Northwest stripe pattern on their sleeves, or what's left of their sleeves. You know, the San Francisco 49ers, from their founding as a All-American Football Conference team back in 1946, have always had three stripes on their sleeves for their jerseys. But because of the abbreviated sleeve templates that we have now, you know, the last, what, dozen years or so, the 49ers have had to go from three stripes to two stripes.
Now the numbers themselves have changed quite a bit.
Yeah, and that's what I was getting to. The second thing was the numbers, because, I mean, if you look at it, probably with the exception of the Chicago Bears having their rounded numbers and thinner font, everybody else always used, like, block numbers,
mm-hmm,
you know, pro-style block numbers. And, I, you know, as a graphic designer, I love me some block numbers because they're really easy to work with. But when you get these stylized number fonts, you know, like what the Rams did this past year, where you've got, you know, the fading of the colors, you've got the rubberized striping inside the number, it's a nightmare for me every time I see a new uniform get unveiled, and I've got to come up with, how the heck am I going to do this? You know, but that's with the sleeves and the number fonts obviously have to be the two biggest changes in jerseys over the years. I mean, yeah, we've gone from crew neck collars to V-neck, and obviously you're talking about the material and everything, but, you know, when you're looking from, you know, you're the seat in the stadium or on TV, you don't really notice the difference in the material so much as you notice, wow, look at the weird number fonts, or like the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, their alarm clock numbers.
Right. Now, where do you see I mean, looking into the future, where do you see uniforms in the NFL going in the near future? Is there any changes on the horizon?
Well, just seeing and hearing a few things, because I always try to keep my ear to the ground. One of the things that I've heard, and again, this can't be confirmed, was that the general manager for the Rams, even though they just came out with new uniforms, said something to a reporter that he'd like to make it so they can introduce a new uniform aspect each year. Like, you know, they've got these blue jerseys and the dishwater-colored bone, I guess is what they call it, colored jerseys, that maybe they'll introduce a yellow jersey next year, or they'll introduce a white jersey next year.
Wow.
He wants to introduce a single uniform characteristic each year, you know, as some kind of big unveiling.
Definitely drive up the jersey sales every year.
Yeah,
like, especially if you have like a Patrick Mahomes fan and you want to have his jersey that he's wearing for the game, you could have quite a closet full.
Yeah, it's definitely the tail wagging the dog, you know. I had another viewer email me the other day saying that because the Seahawks, when they lost in the playoffs, I published up their 2020 yearly image with their collection of jerseys, and he said that ever since week 12, there's been three players that have worn a new Nike template jersey that's different from everybody else on the team, and, you know, the name of, you know, this jersey template escapes me for the moment, but, you know, I said, well, you know, if we can get pictures of it, and at GUD, what we do is we have what we call the rule of three. If we see one thing that's different from everybody else, we kind of ignore it. If we see two people wearing something different from everyone else on the team, well, you know, we got to start paying attention to it. But if there's at least three people doing something different from everybody else, then it's something that we strongly got to consider whether or not, you know, we're going to include it as a separate variation of uniform. And the best example of that I can give would be the Redskins the past couple of years have had about roughly half the team wearing their striped socks upside down. And so we've included, you know, we've created a GIF or a GIF or however you want to say it of the back
ways.
And forth between the two patterns. But, there's apparently a new Nike templated jersey being test-driven by the Seahawks. The Rams want to introduce a new item. And then, obviously, you just have, you know, who are the teams that haven't updated their uniforms recently that could probably stand to use it? And, you know, I was thinking about this last night, and who is most ready for an update to their uniforms? And immediately my mind goes to the Bengals, the Cardinals, the Broncos, and especially the Eagles, because their fans, you talk to almost any Eagle fan, and all they want to do is go back to Kelly Green instead of, you know, the Midnight Green that they got now.
So, I've even seen a lot recently where a lot of the Eagles fans want to go back to the white helmets that had the green Eagle wings on them.
Well, and that would be in connection, another rumor that I have seen more than once or twice is that the competition committee during this offseason is going to strongly look at getting rid of what they call the one helmet rule, where teams are only allowed to wear a single helmet shell during a course of the year, which single-handedly kept teams like Tampa Bay from wearing the white Bucko Bruce helmets, keeps the Patriots from wearing the white Pat Patriot helmet, stuff like that. So there's a strong push to get rid of that particular rule and allow teams to wear more than one helmet shell again, as they were able to do back in the early 2010s before that rule came into existence.
Now, you expressed to me, I mean, we appreciate all this history you're giving us on this, but you've expressed to me that there are still some areas of the gridiron uniform history that you could use some help from our listeners. Maybe they could help you with your research. And if you could tell us a little bit about that.
Absolutely. As I talked earlier about, you know, getting the photographs to be able to say, oh, look, they wore this and this uniform for this game, there comes a point where we've absolutely extinguished all of our online digital newspaper archives for the major metropolitan newspapers. The best example of which I could give would be like Pittsburgh, Detroit, and Chicago. Mm-hmm. Pittsburgh, we have online archives for the Post Gazette and for the Pittsburgh Press. Once you get past those, if there was a game where there wasn't a photo published for whatever reason in one of those two papers, you're out of luck. You're not going to get a photo from that game. Same thing with, you know, we've extinguished the Detroit Free Press. We've extinguished the Chicago Tribune. What we would like to be able to do, and this is where, you know, your broad-ranging listeners could help out if they were so inclined. I live in Florida. I can't go to a Chicago library and dig through Chicago Sun-Times and see if there was a photo from a missing game in the Chicago Sun or whatever other, you know, second or third string newspaper there was. Once you got past the Chicago Tribune, was there a game photo in that other paper that isn't on online archives? Because what I've found is there are towns like Philadelphia, Detroit, Los Angeles is really bad, where unfortunately the public libraries don't want to help you. Some towns have been absolutely gracious as far as looking up photos and saying, here, look, I found a photo of the game you wanted, and sending us, you know, a PDF scan of the newspaper photo from that game so that we knew what uniforms to assign for the two teams in that game. But like Los Angeles, you call any Los Angeles public library and they say, well, we can't afford to dedicate libraries to looking for you. We suggest you contact a local researcher. They charge about $80 to $90 an hour whether they find anything for you or not.
Now, is there like a list that the listeners could go to that you have on your site this of some projects maybe you need their help?
On our forum, in the Gridiron Uniform Database, there's a tab for the forum. And if you go into the forum, I want to quote it just so.
Okay.
So I don't, you know, people aren't looking at the wrong thing. When you click into the forum, it'll first obviously ask you to log in or create a member name, username, so that you can get in. But there's two specific areas. One is NFL preseason research, and the other one is uniform corrections and suggestions. And in the uniform corrections and suggestions, there's a couple separate posts. One says missing games in need of photos, and when you click on that particular entry, you can go in and there's an entire list of the specific games that we need photos from, that we haven't been able to get photos from. That, you know, it's one thing if you're talking about the Redskins versus the Lions in 1948, where, you know, the Redskins only wore one uniform that year. The Lions only wore one uniform that year. You knew what they were going to wear, even though we don't have a photo for it. But any year where a team has more than one combination, we, as, you know, trying to be as historically accurate as we can, we don't want to guess one thing and then somebody supply us a photo, you know, months or years later saying, you're wrong.
Right, yeah, you don't want to have that.
This was it. So, but the big ones are if you have anybody that is in the Philadelphia, Detroit, Los Angeles, New York, especially Brooklyn. Oh, we are so hurting for Brooklyn Dodgers photographs and Staten Island Stapletons.
Wow.
Anything in that New York area, if you know you have access to a Brooklyn library that has Brooklyn newspapers, we would love to hear from you. Chicago, Cleveland, Boston and Pittsburgh, those are the big ones. If we could get people to help us out in those cities, you know, we could fill in a couple dozen of our missing games, and it would be so much the better. As it is now, we have workable photos all the way back through the 1950s. I think in the 1950s, we're missing one game from 1950 and
gosh,
one game from 1955. And the 1950 game, I'm not holding out much hope because it was a night game featuring the Browns at the Steelers. It was the first ever Browns-Steelers game in Pittsburgh at Forbes Field. But the problem was, the game was being held during a newspaper strike in Pittsburgh. And
what about somebody who happened to be at that game and maybe took a photograph, you know?
That would be great. That would be great. You know, unfortunately, I have no way of posting something, you know, a general, you know, Google alert saying, hey, by the way, anybody that happens to have a picture from October 7th, 1950 of the Browns-Steelers game, you know, shoot me a line. So,
Well, perhaps our listeners can help you out with that. We appreciate your time. Could you give us your website address again and any Twitter handle or any way people can get a hold of you if they have some of that information for you?
Okay, I got a bunch of ways. The website itself is www.gridiron-uniforms.com. My email directly to me is my name and my wife's name, Bill and Garen, BillandGaren, at Verizon.net. And both myself and the actual website both have Twitter handles. Mine is at GUDBILL13 on Twitter. So it's capital G, capital U, capital D, capital B, I-L-L, and then the number 13. And then the website is at Gridiron Uniform on Twitter also.
All right, Bill. Well, we appreciate your time and sharing all this great history that you and your team have done over at the Gridiron Uniform Database. And we'll look forward to everybody visiting them. Again, we're going to put that link on our show notes of the podcast. You can also find it on pigskindispatch.com. And, Bill, once again, thank you for sharing that football history with us and getting us started on this, embarking on this project.
Not a problem. Thank you for having me, Darren. I appreciate it.
Well, that was truly an informative experience and discussion with Bill Schaefer. Make sure you check him out at thegridironuniform.com. It's a great site, and it's really appealing to the eye, and you'll learn a lot about the gridiron uniforms of the professional game of the NFL. Well, I just wanted to make sure that you check us out daily, because we're still going to continue to do this podcast, even though we're in the off season. It's pigskindispatch.com/podcast. You can see all of our episodes if you want to do some binge listening to the podcast. Go back all the way to beginning of September when we started this podcast. Or you can go to our great site, pigskindispatch.com, and check out all of the articles that we have, as well as maybe check out our YouTube channel at Pigskin Dispatch. We'll be on social media throughout the offseason every day. We're going to have some contests coming up. And we are still part of the sportshistorynetwork.com, where you have some great sports history content. So if you're ready to shift into some other sports, go to baseball or basketball, we have some of those sports too. You can check it out there with some great hosts, very talented, and some excellent guests that they have. And speaking of guests, we're going to have a lot of guests coming up here during this offseason. Like I said, February 25th, we have the legendary Upton Bell, the son of Burt Bell, that we spoke about earlier, is going to be on our podcast. And he's got some very interesting things to say, as well as a lot of other folks in between there that are going to talk about our uniform jersey series coming up through the next few months, as we're going to go through from zeros all the way to 99 in the off season. So until tomorrow, folks, have a great gridiron day. And thanks for joining us. We'll be right back. Peeking up at the clock, the time's running down. We're going to go into victory formation, take a knee, and let this baby run out. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you back tomorrow for the next podcast. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com. Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Do you wish you knew more about the 100 seasons of the NFL? You're in luck because you found the Football History Dude podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. From the founding of the league in an auto showroom, all the way to what it is today, America's favorite sport and a behemoth of an industry. My name is Ernie Chapman. Football is my passion, and I want you to come along with me each week to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board my DeLorean, and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.